Welcome to the I Know Strange People podcast, the artist interview podcast that explores the unconventional in the creative process. I'm your host, Jeffrey Marbito. Today, I interview Martin Dull. Now, Martin is a friend of mine, and he's someone I first met a few years ago at the basement of the New York Studio School. If someone was to describe Martin, I think most people would consider him a very earnest person, a little bit of a cheeseball. I mean, he calls his, I believe he calls his email dull art or something like that. So, but it's good because he does not take himself too seriously. At the same time, as you can tell from this interview, he is able to look at himself very frankly and honestly and talks about his life, his work, and his faith and how it's incorporated in this creative process. So here is Martin Dull. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Jeff.
Happy New Year's.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. How are you doing today? The first day of a new year, new decade?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to see what this year holds. I feel like it can't get much worse coming out of 2020, knock on wood.
Right. I think we said this in 2016, 2017, 2018, 20. Anyhow, but yeah, well, you know, I guess what's interesting about odd times is that it wasn't that predictable, at least in the form it is right now.
Yeah. Well, at least we have a vaccine on the way, or so it would seem.
Right. Well, I guess I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but one of the most, I think, pertinent things to talk about is how have you been doing in the pandemic in terms of your life and your art and how you're just keeping, I guess, everything together in these times?
That's a good question. I have been keeping it together, and I think it's one of those situations where you just adjust accordingly because you're kind of thrown into a situation where you have no other option. But the reality is that although my situation changed, it didn't necessarily change for the worse. It appeared that way at the beginning because a lot of shows that I had coming up and things I had in the works sort of fell dead in the water when the pandemic started. But I sort of quickly recovered. I set up a studio out in the country just to get away from the city for a while, since New York at the time was doing very poorly with numbers. And I started working. I started working out in rural New Jersey, and I actually found that to be a very rewarding change of pace for me. I was able to sort of focus on a new body of work, break with old ideas, sever old ties. So in that sense, it was rewarding in this odd way. And I also had the fortunate situation of having a job where not only did it continue through quarantine, but I was actually promoted and hired into a more substantial position at the place that I was working. So all in all, it's been a challenging year, but for me personally, it hasn't been a devastating year.
So I know that, previously we actually were almost studio neighbors when we both had a studio in Bushwick. And I know for years you've been on and off having a studio in New York City or the New York City vicinity. But I also know that you also, get sick of the city and you always need to go out, get some fresh air, some nature. So do you think living or working in rural New Jersey has affected your work, and in what way?
Well, it definitely affected my work, and it was a temporary situation because I was working out of a garage, a two-car garage. So
there's
nothing
wrong with a garage. A garage has provided many artists with good fodder.
No, it was a fantastic space, especially since we went on quarantine in March, and it was really end of March, early April that I started using the space. So the weather was starting to get warmer. Where I was out in rural New Jersey can get some very nasty winter weather. And working out of a garage becomes difficult when there's no heat and there's a couple of feet of snow on the ground, or, there's 20 degree temperatures. But in the summer, it was great because, one, there's extended sunlight and I could actually just open the door of the garage. And for the first time, I discovered what it's like to really work in direct sunlight and how to kind of read the time of the day based on how the light was falling on my work. And light's always been an important part of my work. However, because of the way, urban areas are set up and affordability and lack of options, I usually had to provide that light artificially. But working in actual daylight, I think a combination of that and the slowing down of the pandemic brought me closer to a sense of, I began finessing the colors in the work in a way that that didn't feel necessary before. And a lot of things that I would think about color became more real in the new environment that I was in. I also think that just a certain sense of color and composition change simply being in a rural landscape. I mean, you're inevitably, whatever I encounter visually during my day-to-day routine filters into the work. Since I'm an abstract painter, it's just part of the process.
Right.
And I don't try to necessarily push it out when it comes to content in terms of color or form. So I think being in the new environment definitely affected the work. And I like to believe it affected the work in a very positive way. One, for the slowing down, and two, for this sort of heightened sense and naturally rooted sense of color.
Well, I've been in this garage before, this garage studio. During the summertime, it was quite hot. And what I noticed about the natural light was that it was mostly a refracted light coming off from the driveway and the other buildings and the grass. And the light seemed to consistently change. So I think in some ways it was a little bit, this is how I imagine it, since the light is consistently but slowly changing, it kind of set up a certain routine for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I found myself, there were specific times that working in the light was optimal. There's a point in the morning where the refracted light sort of set this kind of even glow to everything. And then sort of late morning around noon, the sun would get to a certain point where the light would enter into the space and it would become really sharp. So you'd have these kind of harsh shadows and sometimes the glare was just too much. So I kind of would schedule my day around those moments where there would be glare or heightened shadows. I might take that time to do something else. So yeah, in a weird way, my painting routine was dictated by the sun, I guess.
Well, that's how it was for hundreds of years, I guess, before unless for those old school painters who only painted by candlelight, but they were always a little bit too dark for my taste.
Well, it was interesting too, because then I would often end up working into the evening, but if I was working into the evening, it was more about dealing with other concerns, but leaving color concerns out of it, because in the evening I would turn on the lights I had in there, and I did buy a couple of kind of cheap cans and more expensive bulbs from the local Home Depot. But even then, I couldn't capture the purity of the color that the sunlight bathing the work just captured. And that's not so much a concern for me in displaying the work once it's completed, but what I realized is in the process of making the work, where I'm dealing with one color up against another color, seeing those colors in natural light really allows me to experience what's going on.
Let me ask you this. Have you been traditionally more of a day painter or night painter, or either or? It didn't really matter that much.
That's funny. I was reading an article about somebody who was discussing this topic, and she was talking about how she's a night painter. And I never really thought about this before, but when I read that, I realized I think I'm just a painter. It doesn't really matter to me whether I'm painting in the day or I'm painting at night. I go through cycles. It depends. Sometimes it depends on the season. You know, in the summer, I'm usually up all night, and you know, I'm afforded more daylight even if I'm not getting up super early in the morning. But
right. On
this time of year, I'm usually getting up early, and when I'm up, I'm thinking about painting, or I'm in the studio painting. So I don't know if I deal with it the way that I think a lot of painters deal with it, which is, you know, they feel inspired at night, or they feel inspired in the morning. I think I just go with when I feel inspired, which could be any time.
Right, right. Yeah.
I feel myself walking down the street at times, and all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. And I'll have to like figure out how to rush myself to the studio to get a paintbrush in my hand to like get that idea down on the canvas. You know,
it's not necessarily like, I know for some artists, they like to, anybody, even writers, songwriters, they romanticize working at nighttime. I think I forgot the direct quote from John Lennon, but he even said like being an artist is about what you need to do 3 a.m. or something.
Well, isn't there a famous book about Guston called Night Studio?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So like working at different times of the day has always been, especially in the evening, a lot of people have romanticized that. And I think I've done a little bit half and half. I think working in the evening has always been productive just because it was less distractions.
True. Well, what I will say is that on any given day, I'm usually, if it really is a day that I've set aside for studio work, I tend to get myself there. I like to say that I'm going to get there by 10 a.m., but it usually ends up being around noon. But I'll get right to the studio around noon. And what ends up happening is that I'll get myself started. But, you know, if you're slinging paint around or you're thinking about what you're doing in the studio, sometimes it takes so long to warm up that it won't be till like 5 or 6 o'clock at night that I'll actually get that rhythm going, and I'll kind of be out of my own head and out of my own way. So in that sense, I become a night painter by default, even though I'm at the studio trying to paint during the day.
Yeah, no, I, sometimes when I found myself becoming a night painter, I always blamed it on how short the day was.
There's never enough time.
Right. Well, let's talk about maybe your first studio experiences, or maybe your first, maybe a little bit further back, your first artist experiences. Your first experience being making art. So I understand you were actually home raised for a certain degree of your younger years, right?
Yeah. So I was
homeschooled. Actually, yeah, homeschooled is the proper term for it.
At the time, there was a network of homeschoolers in the Midwest, but I didn't grow up in the Midwest. I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in suburban New Jersey, right outside of New York City. And I think I was maybe the only child in my county that was actually homeschooled. And my mom had been a school teacher for years. And I'm an only child, and I think she just she felt that she could give me a much broader education than what she felt the public and private schools in the area offered. And we weren't necessarily a family with deep pockets, so
right,
private school options were limited.
Where did you get your first exposure to art? Was it through homeschooling or when you went into the public school system, or something you just found on your own?
Visual art is not something that I was in any traditional sense exposed to until I got, so I was homeschooled from K to eighth, and then I went to the local Catholic high school for high school. So my really traditional exposure to art education wasn't until I got to high school. However, I grew up in a family. My dad's a musician and a producer of folk music. And he used to bring folk artists into North Jersey to play at different theaters. And he would open for the acts, and national and international acts at times too. So I grew up in a very, artistic community, although it was more of an auditory community than a visual community. But my earliest memories as a child are drawing, and not just drawing in the sense that I think a lot of people just draw. It was always a true form of language to me. It was always something that I either needed to express or something that I saw that I wanted to make my own imaginary world of that thing that I saw or that I wanted. Like I said, my family didn't have deep pockets growing up. So, you know, all my friends had different, you know, fancy toys. And, you know, this is
right.
I mean, the height of my youth is the 90s. So there's all these cool, like, you know, transforming robots that like glow in the dark and can like walk and stuff like that. And all my friends had this stuff and I didn't. So I became fascinated with making these things for myself because one, I was an only child, so I was all alone. And two, I didn't have the toys that I wanted that everybody else had. So I would see them and then I'd go home and I'd try to duplicate them in paper or with Legos.
I made a lot of copies of popular toys out of Legos in my day.
So, I mean, it's just always been there. And I was lucky to grow up in a family that was very supportive of those interests that I displayed very early on in my life. They never discouraged them and they never made them out to be unimportant. They were always equally as important as learning to read or learning math. So I was very lucky in that sense.
So you mentioned you first started attending school at a Catholic high school. And I know that you're a Catholic, not just culturally, but you actually go to church or believe in Catholicism. And it's something that has made your way into your work quite often, it seems. Especially certain phrases that you scribble in your work. So I'm kind of wondering, I mean, actually, I can really quite go down a rabbit hole of questions there. But
it's an interesting rabbit hole to go down, but it can certainly be a dangerous rabbit hole.
Well, it's, I mean, I can see it a couple of different ways to look at it. There is something about, I mean, I never really went to church. As you know, my I'm culturally Catholic just because my father's like very Italian, but he also really believes in football on Sundays. So we never went to church. But with that said, you know, there's an admiration I always had for religious art, especially during the Renaissance. And there's something about, I guess that, I guess I can relate to in terms of the religious sense and the creative sense, a certain sense of wonder. I don't know if there's any overlap you find in your faith with the actual creative process or some sort of gratification or, I don't know. It's like, for example, I've seen in your, I mean, this may sound kind of tacky, but I remember in one of your paintings, you wrote down like, why have you forsaken me? And I've seen enough, Jesus movies to know where that's from. But I also wonder, so it kind of leads up to an obvious question. Is there a certain form of salvation in making art? Which I know I'm taking quite a few steps ahead of what I initially asked.
Yeah. No, I think I can begin to unpack some of this stuff. So to clarify, I wouldn't say I'm a particularly religious person. I find organized religion in general fascinating because it has such a rich history. And when you actually look at the, like in terms of what I know best, which would be the Catholic Mass, because that's, you know, I was raised as a Roman Catholic. When you sit down and you break apart like the different parts of the Mass or the different rituals that you go through during that hour and a half or whatever, where people gather to worship, everything has a purpose and a reason that's metaphorical or staunchly believed in as actual, that harkens back to some passage in the Bible or some tradition that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think art is similar in that way. And the reason that I take Catholic imagery or text that would be familiar in the Christian faith, like why have you forsaken me? The reason I use those things is simply because that's what's closest to me. That's what I'm familiar with. But I think through the visual arts, you're injecting universality back into it. So instead of becoming...
When you take something that's a reference to Roman Catholicism, so for example, why have you forsaken me? Is that meant to be a metaphor or is it meant to be taken literally, as you said, part of all the aspects of the Mass that you find fascinating?
I mean, to me as an artist, anything through the language of art, even if it is a literal statement, because it's through the lens of art, which puts it through a sort of lens of history and a lens of the contemporary, it is meant to be read as a metaphor. And I think it's also meant to be associated with things that otherwise wouldn't be associated with it. And that particular phrase and that particular painting, that came about during the height of the protests in 2020 for George Floyd. And I was thinking about this idea of betrayal, but betrayal in a big way, systemic, societal betrayal. And then I was thinking about, what do I understand about betrayal, or what stories do I know, or what history makes sense to me and my background? And I was thinking, you know, there's this story about this man they called Jesus that was supposed to be God sent to earth, that was then murdered by his human half. And as he's being murdered, he cries out to God, his other half. So there's an internal struggle going on there, and he cries out, "Why have you forsaken me?" As if this moment, at this moment, everything's gone. Everybody's betrayed him. He's all alone. But in that moment, or right after that moment, there's this beautiful story of the 3 days and the resurrection. So it's a poignant loaded message that contains this odd glimmer of hope behind it. And it just seemed to associate with the moment that I think we were all experiencing in our own ways. It seemed to associate with that moment well in my eyes. And anyway, that's how that text came into that painting. But in a formal sense, there are other things going on. That painting compositionally harkens back to an El Greco crucifixion scene that I saw back when I was a student studying paintings at the Louvre.
Well, I've definitely, I'm definitely a very big fan of, I think, almost every single crucifixion painting ever made. They're always my favorite to a certain degree. And yeah, I think a lot of times this past year, we've all kind of wondered when the world has gone to shit, well, how to kind of find hope in this situation at the time. So let me ask you this, though. Is there anything in your paintings that, or your art, or anything that you're trying to express or say, or whatever you decide to call your art practice, that is meant to be taken literally?
The objectness of them. That's really the only literal thing. But as soon as they become...
I knew this answer, by the way. I was setting you up for that.
Well, because as soon as... they are the object that they are. That's a very literal thing. But as soon as they're put into a context, as soon as they're displayed or presented to somebody, and somebody forms an opinion about them, that's where the metaphor begins. That's where the reality, in a sense, ceases and the imagination begins. Because even if they're looking at the real object, they're looking at it as an art object. And before it's even an art object, the most literal thing it is an object or a bunch of objects or materials thrown together. And it's part of the reason I think the aesthetic quality to my work can be very raw, because I think it's important, especially in contemporary society where so many things are shrouded in all these ideas, or I hesitate to use the word lies, but there's a lot of things that we see or feel or do that we take as truth or we take as fact that are not necessarily truth or fact. But something being what it is factual.
Right. Well, it kind of goes, I mean, you can say something about it's very Duchampian, the way you're trying to put an object into a painting. And in terms of the lie, well, traditionally, a lot of art was meant to be perceived almost as a form of magic. The illusion was not meant to be, it wasn't meant to be all the technical things that we know now, what makes an illusion, wasn't part of what art was. It was meant to be a magic, a form of visual subversion. You can say a lie. And that is to a certain degree art at one point in time, but when you actually put a piece of a machine in the painting, it doesn't, it can still exist as a machine
I think the illusion was absolutely necessary when art and advertising were one and the same thing, or were necessary for each other. And when you talk about art in terms of especially traditional art, like crucifixion things in scenes, those are pictures that are also supposed to give illiterate people a message that they otherwise might not receive, and kind of awe them and shock them, the way that advertisements in Times Square could be awe-inspiring or shocking. But now we have advertisements in Times Square, so I don't think there's the necessity for those two things to be together anymore. But I do think there's another type of illusion that painting and sculpture and art in general can provide. And this is what I'm actually really interested in. And it's an illusion of sensation. And I think it's sensation that's drawn from the conflation of ideas and elements. When you start to put lots of things together, in an age where you can go on Google, let's say, and literally search for anything you want and extract any sort of meaning or fact from anything you want, and probably find somebody else who thinks the same thing across the globe. I think that's an interesting idea that seems to be, in my mind, in tune with this idea of conflation, the kind of conflation that can happen in the visual arts, where you start to put things together that by their nature hold a narrative or hold a history. Why have you forsaken me? You know, that holds a narrative and it holds a history that, when taken outside of its narrative and history and placed somewhere else, then combines with that other thing and starts to create a new alternate narrative or a subversion or whatever we want to call it.
Right. Well, these days it's, I can say that the crucifixion has changed throughout the centuries, even when religion was much more important in our daily lives. At one point in time, it was a point of privilege to look at a crucifixion painting. And I know that I was reading this one book called The Art of Images, or The Power of Images, who I actually borrowed that book from someone. I should probably return it to them eventually. But
the one with the hand and the triangle on the cover?
Right, yes, that book.
What are you talking about?
Yeah. It's Cecilia. I even forgot the name of the artist I borrowed it from. Anyhow, she got pregnant, so I decided not to bother her and I kept the book. But I was reading, they had a great portion of the book on the crucifixion and how it went from being a position of privilege to see a painting, a crucifixion painting. And at one point in time, it was so propagated that it was meant to be a tool of comfort, and that if someone was on their deathbed, or even if someone was meant to be executed for a crime, that it was very important they had access to see a crucifixion beforehand. So it was definitely this type of... I guess it's meant to be a tool or a vessel of salvation for whoever sees it. And that has changed. And now we have other different visual devices that's supposed to give us maybe not salvation anymore. I would say these days perhaps more comfort.
Well, I certainly don't want to give people...
comfort?
Well, I was going to say that I don't want to give people comfort in my work. However, and I do this, I think, in a different way, but like de Kooning used to say that he would leave a part of the painting open because you always needed a door or a way to get out of the painting.
He has a great painting called, I think, Door to Something. Something.
Door to the River. Yep.
Yeah, Door to the River. Yeah. It's currently up at the Whitney right now, actually.
Yeah. But that idea of the doorway or the way out. So in my work, I do like to leave that moment of, you know, as heavy as the work can get, I like there to be this moment of levity or some sort of way visually or viscerally to give the viewer a sense that we might be in a heavy place or we might be dealing with something heavy here, but there's hope. I think hope's an important thing to always keep somewhere embedded in the work. Otherwise, it's just a very nihilistic thing to do, isn't it?
Right. Well, a little nihilism can't hurt, but...
yeah, it's post the 90s. You know,
I did think...
Math is over.
I kind of remember when you had a solo show with Michael David 2 years ago, and I got to see you hang the show before it actually opened. And I think, and I got to see all the paintings you're working on at the time. And I thought to myself, and I might've shared it with you, that like, oh, you've made a car accident.
Yes.
So I think that kind of
car accident, right? Like in a weird way, there's beauty in tragedy. I mean, like that's the power of, something like, you know, Shakespeare's tragic plays or something like the story of Romeo and Juliet. I mean, that there's such a beauty in that, even though it's so tragic, right?
Definitely. I mean, there's a certain romance to tragedy and, well, there's a story to it. And yeah. Sometimes we associate actual physical manifestations with the actual story itself. So let me ask you this about the style of painting that you do. You have objects in your paintings, but a quick way, for the sake of expediency, you can say that you paint in the form of abstract expressionism, or hip people these days would just call it ab-X, especially right. When you find it in tiny type on walls of galleries. But a lot have changed in the art world and the way people perceive what is art and who made their art since the ab-X days in the 50s. A lot of times now, art is not necessarily just what it is, but what the message is supposed to be and who is the maker and what's the point of view. And I think there's a lot of celebration and criticism in ab-X painting now. I use the hip acronyms ab-X, A-B, E-X, that it was mostly just through a male point of view. And that's really been the most, and probably rightly so. I mean, I think generally speaking, Jackson Pollock's wife, Lee Krasner, had a great body of work, and she gets much less attention than Jackson Pollock. And he was a raving alcoholic that got someone killed when he died. So in a car accident.
Sure.
So there is some,
in terms of those historical facts, where male painters got a lot of attention, basically Anglo-white male painters got a lot of attention, and a lot of other artists did not get the attention they deserved. I mean, I think that that's tragic, and I think it is about time that there's been a reckoning in the art world and in the art historical world of this issue. But I also hesitate to think that automatically discounts a style or an accomplishment if that style or that accomplishment or that movement was powerful. I think it can be understood for what it is without losing its importance. You know, I think we can write things into history without totally abolishing things from history or completely rewriting history.
I guess I'm also asking you, is this something you're considering in terms of how one can update Abex painting?
Absolutely. Actually, this has been, up until fairly recently, this was something that I thought about a lot. And in fact, in graduate school, I went up in front of a panel of professionals, and you know, it's that moment right before you're most likely going to receive your MFA, and they kind of tell you everything that's wrong with you.
I always took it as a compliment. The harder they tried, the more threatening they thought you would be.
Well, let me tell you, they tried hard, and the biggest criticism was, you know, what was it? Well, why even do this if you're just going to be a bad de Kooning? And at the time, you know, the paintings were much more derivative. I mean, I think that that's just the natural progression of things. You go through school, you learn things, you're influenced by things. But after that panel, I was very upset. And it really made me take inventory of what led me to where I was at that moment, where I wanted to go in the future. And I posed a question to myself. I said, well, all these things they criticized me for, are they things that I can lose, can get rid of in the work to improve the work? Or are they things that I'm not willing to put aside? And if after that type of criticism, I'm not willing to put those things aside, then I guess they're just a part of my language as an artist. And I better focus even more intensely on those problems to make them so my own that they, yes, talk to all of these earlier influences, but have their own identity separate from the influences that led up to where they are. And I think that I now feel that I am speaking in my own voice, which I'm not saying that I'm anywhere near figuring anything out. I just feel like I am speaking my language through painting now, not I'm speaking through painting through other languages that I feel akin to or something. I feel like these paintings are mine at this point. But for a very long time, I had to struggle with the idea that I was trying to figure out how to reinvent the wheel without actually reinventing the wheel, but making something new out of the wheel. Maybe I wanted to make the wheel a handlebar. I don't know. But I was trying to figure that out.
I feel like you actually put an actual wooden wheel or something in one of your paintings, right?
It's in one of them. It's in one of the paintings or the sculptures or something in between. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff.
So you've literally put the wheel in, and it wasn't a metaphor at all. So in the process of, overcoming, apprehension of making bad de Koonings, as a lot of other painters feel like they've had to confront with, any things you felt like you had to take on or perhaps shed?
Take on or shed. I mean, there's always things to take on, and there's always things that we're constantly shedding. I think for me anyway, I think sometimes the most difficult thing is to realize that you need to shed something or get to a point where you do shed it.
Was this something that just happens, I guess, just from the process of everything?
Yeah, you know, I'm in there and I'm working and I'm in there and I'm working. And then sometimes I can't be in there and I can't work. But I always find myself back in the studio and working again. And I used to try to make a routine out of it, or I used to try to figure out what was going on or what I was doing. And that always posed an issue, because every time I would try to figure it out, I would paint myself into a hole and I'd kill things. If I just go into the studio as some sort of like excited investigator, or I don't know, some sort of child at a candy store, I can go in there and I can do a lot of stuff. Nobody may ever see that stuff that I do, but in the middle of doing all that stuff, I can build my critical eye and start to say, ooh, I'm taking that with me. Or, ooh, I'm taking that with me. And then things start to appear. Bodies of work start to develop. But they're not... there's nothing... I have no interest in preconceiving what's going to happen. I'd rather go in blind, let things happen, and then realize what happened. And whatever's worth keeping with me, I'll keep with me. Whatever's worth throwing away, I'll throw away. Or I never throw things away, but it'll probably end up in a painting or a sculpture or something somewhere.
Right. So before I got onto Zoom with you, I was listening to a certain album called, let me look it up, the one I was listening to. It was called The Shape of Punk to Come.
Funny you should bring up that album.
I know, coincidentally. But that is an album that you cite in the press release for your upcoming show called New Noise. I listened to a couple of tracks. I enjoyed it. Some of it was more hardcore. Some of it was more punk-like. But why don't you explain, how did you get that title, New Noise, for your show coming up?
So I was going through trying to figure out what title, what kind of summarized this new body of work that... That I was gonna put on display, and we brought up this idea of conflation in contemporary art before, and I realized that one of my big influences is auditory, it's sound and it's music, and not that I'm listening to music while I make particular pieces of work, but I listen to music. And I carry those sounds in my mind with me into the work. I also find visual art for whatever reason, visual art also gives me an auditory sensation. I can kind of hear what I'm seeing.
Oh, I mean, I think that's actually very natural.
I think it's natural, but some people don't understand that.
I would say it has, I definitely know some people who don't, I don't want to say they just put it down, but I think some people actually just find that confusing or find it a little bit perhaps pretentious to try to say that, because some people push that idea. What's that term called where you can taste the sound, sense something?
Synesthesia.
Right. Yeah. I feel like that's a bit of an overused term these days, but I've always seen,
I think it's where you can taste color.
I mean, I have tasted my oil paints by mistake before, but,
Well, I don't want to get too off track here either, though, as far as the album.
Right. But I do think that actually it's when you see a painting that actually has a certain sound or reminds you of music, it's just you can call it a conflation of things that you love.
Right. Well, and that's it. And the interesting thing about this particular album is that in the hardcore, post-hardcore punk world, kind of in the early 2000s, this album comes out, and it's better produced than a lot of the albums. It takes more risks than a lot of other peer albums that were put out, and as an album itself, it comes across as this wall of noise sometimes, but after you listen to it for a while, you realize how structured and how poetic that wall of noise is. And once you get past the idea that it's noise and you start to hear it for what it actually is, you start to be able to slow down with it, and you start to be able to see or feel or hear the poetry that's there. And I'd like to have my work do something similar to that, where you're caught by it at first because it seems like this loud, noisy, or aggressive thing that you've just been confronted with. But then if you give it a little bit of time, it starts to slow down and you start to unpack it, and you start to find out that there's all these moments contained in there that that bring a certain poetry forward. I mean, that's what I'd like my work to do. But anyway, so one of the tracks on this album is called New Noise. And I like the alliteration of that title. I also thought that being that it's a January show, being that I'm interested in this idea of something that's sort of loud and captures your attention, but is also poetic and new, I thought that alliteration and that title fit. But the title is off an album called The Shape of Punk to Come, which is this hardcore album that I was talking about that sort of redefines, breaks boundaries, and pushes the genre forward. And that album itself actually steals, or its title gives a nod to a much older album called The Shape of Jazz to Come, which was an album that kind of repackaged, redefined, and gave a real sound to avant-garde jazz music. So now you have that sort of train track of history coming through, and all these threads into things that, you know, somebody can walk up and they can look at the title of the show and go, New Noise, cool title, sounds like an interesting show. Oh, I like the show. Or if they know a little bit about it, they might go, oh, I know that album, I know that band. Oh, I wonder how the work like associates with it, and then draw their conclusions there. Or they might know even more about history and they go, whoa, this is talking about jazz, and this is talking about, so.
Right.
The title itself is a game and a play on history and words and kind of train tracks of different threads of thought, the same way that I think of the paintings and the sculptures as these coalescing of threads of thoughts and chains of instinct and intuition and history all coming together.
So, obviously, as I listen to you talk about this album, this is a very important album for you that kind of defines a lot what you like in music, and perhaps what you, oh, got a reminder to buy Lemon and Lime. I got to turn off reminders on my computer. But anyway, so I guess what I'm wanting to ask is that you feel like this album defines, to a certain degree, defines who you are, and probably someone of well, who you are at that point in time when it came out. So with that said, do you think the paintings that you're doing now and the art that you make, do you want it to be represented a certain zeitgeist of what's happening around you also?
Yes, I think zeitgeist is a good word, because it's not even that...
And just like that album, not just the zeitgeist of what's happening with our generation now, but also giving that specific nod to the past.
Well, that's, yeah, the nod to the past. And it's more than just a nod to an album. It's a nod to an idea. All of these things, even art in itself to me is more... Nodding to an album would be like a literal thing, but nodding to an album because the idea associates with your idea, that's a much broader territory. It's a much more fertile terrain. And I think that's where I go with these things. It's more that I'm nodding to moments of ideas where things came together in a certain type of clarity. So it's not so much an endorsement of purely the album, but it's also an endorsement of the zeitgeist around the album. I think it relates to the work in the sense that the work deals with the zeitgeist around the work. So it's about more than the things themselves.
No, that's interesting. Right. I always saw these... I get a little bit confused at times when a work is supposed to, or any type of art or music or movie is supposed to represent the zeitgeist of the times. I always find it very circumstantial about how things line up. But maybe that's how you unpack how art represents the zeitgeist of the times. Certain circumstances, the things line up.
Well, I think it's easy to unpack things when they're in the past. I think it's impossible to unpack things when they're in the present, which is why loading something in the present with a bunch of stuff from the past and also a bunch of stuff from the present, maybe when people go back and look and unpack it 10 years from now, if that ever was to happen, they would catch much more about what it means than we're capable of catching in the moment.
Well, okay. I think, we can try that 10 years from now, right?
I also think it's the duty of an artist not to just talk to today, but to also consider how what you're doing today might talk to tomorrow. Because I think artists are supposed to live in the present, but always be trying to move things forward. Otherwise, I mean, then who moves the world forward? Politicians, they suck at moving the world forward. People in general suck at moving the world forward. I think artists have an interesting opportunity to expand a mind and have people think outside of the box, which is, I think by nature, that's moving forward.
Right. Yeah, I think it's, well, for a lot of artists and any creative type, it's almost creative suicide to not move forward. It's a little bit like a fish. You have to swim or you'll sink.
Yeah. But if you're a really good fish, you're like a salmon and you swim upstream to spawn. So you don't even, it's not even about just not sinking. It's about also laying a bunch of eggs in a place that you can't even get to without trying really hard.
Right. And like a salmon, sometimes you like the salty water and sometimes you want it a bit fresh. Okay, that's really cool, Martin. Now it's time for the lightning round of the interview, where I ask you movies about questions, because I've never made a movie, but I aspire to make one day. So let me ask you some questions about movies. What's your favorite holiday film?
Ooh, favorite holiday film.
Right. By the way, just to let you know, I finally watched Jingle All the Way recently. That was, well, anyway, that's a hope for a whole different podcast, but please continue.
Great special effects.
Oh my, the jetpack.
You know, I if I'm going to be really sincere, it's A Wonderful Life.
Ah, that is a good movie, though.
It is. It's just a perfect holiday movie that's... I also like holiday movies that aren't purely about the holiday. But oddly enough, right up there with It's a Wonderful Life, which would... I have to put that at number one. Number two might actually be Die Hard.
Yeah, Die Hard 1 and 2.
Die Hard 1.
I remember listening to the radio recently where they were making an argument that Die Hard 2 is better than Die Hard 1.
One's just a really good movie, though. Everything in 1 is semi-plausible. 2, towards the end, gets a little fantastic.
Right. Well, in connection to that, I could almost guess that you would like Die Hard or It's a Wonderful Life. What's your favorite movie that your friends would never guess you like?
Huh. That's a good question. That they'd never guess I like. You caught me off guard with this one. I don't know. Can we come back to that?
You can definitely come back to that one. Okay. What movie did you wish you saw for the first time when you were older?
When I was older?
Like, was there a movie that you thought, I mean, I can think of some for myself where I couldn't appreciate it.
When you were younger, but you can appreciate it now.
Right.
Citizen Kane.
When was the last time you saw Citizen Kane?
The last time was actually a long time ago, but the first time I saw it, I was like 6 or 7 years old, and I thought it was stupid and I couldn't stand it.
Right. I actually re-saw it maybe 2-3 weeks ago.
There's another movie that I've seen very recently that I didn't like when I was a child that is a really good movie. Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, okay. I mildly remember that.
I like that movie now, but I didn't. I mean, it was just boring to me as a child.
Hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, Citizen Kane was pretty mind-blowing how Trumpian the whole storyline was, actually. Okay. What movie has the most value for you as an artist?
Most value for me as an artist.
In terms of what you do, what you make, how you go about it.
Okay, so the one that comes to my mind at this moment, and this is because I just saw it again yesterday or the day before, and this doesn't have to do with my visual art, but I also mess around on the guitar a bit. And have you ever seen the movie Black Snake Moan?
Yes, I have.
It inspired me. It gave me an answer to a problem I was having with a riff that I was putting together for a song.
Oh, okay. That's good to hear that it inspired you to kidnap someone.
So the next step is now I need to chain somebody up in my apartment to listen to me play the song.
So on that note, we're going to end this interview.
Oh, movie people might not guess that I really like, though. Disney's A Christmas Carol, the one with Scrooge and Mickey.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I do kind of remember that film.
Just watched it again this Christmas. I don't know. I have holidays on my brain, but I don't think people would automatically go, he really likes that movie, because I still really like that movie.
Right, right. Yeah, no. It's I mean, I like, I don't know. I think there's some occasional, I like a lot of pretentious artsy films, and I like a lot of B movies, and I like the whole gamblet of everything.
The Naked Gun.
How about 33 and a third?
Also good. All of them.
Okay. Now, these are all great films, actually. I seriously suggest anyone see Naked Gun and A Christmas Carol, perhaps back to back.
Anything with Leslie Nielsen's pretty good.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's amazing how he gets these body doubles for his films. Okay. It was really great talking to you, Martin.
You as well, Jeff.
All right. Well, have a. I wish you many successes in your show coming up, and I guess a safe new year, as with everyone else, right?
Thank you. Yeah, just doing what we can to stay COVID free.
Definitely. Take care, Martin.
See you, Jeff.
Okay, that was Martin Dull. As you can tell, he is a very frank and earnest person. He likes his painting. He draws a lot from his faith. And he also likes his punk rock quite a lot. So his new show, New Noise, at Rexa Gallery, is up until February 12th. You can check out his other artwork at martindellart.com. And music today was provided to you by Michael J. Vitale. His music is featured on his website, michaeljvitaleband.com. So if you know of any strange people, please drop a line with any comments or inquiries. Until next time, I hope everyone out there stays strange.